I'm Jesse Thorne. This is The Turnaround. The show where I ask interviewers about interviewing. It's a partnership between Maximum Fun and the Columbia Journalism Review. My guest this week is Ira Glass. He created and hosts This American Life, which has now spun out into several super smash mega hit podcasts. He's a real genius, like a genuine genius, and he's one of those guys who, let me put it this way, a lot of people work really hard, practice a ton to get good at what they do. They build up this incredible kind of mental muscle memory. And Ira has done that, but he also has a reason he can explain for every single choice that he makes. I think that's why he's been able to basically teach a generation of public radio producers to make things the way that he saw them in his mind when he started his show 20 or so years ago. It's also a wonderful thing for our project. This was actually one of the last interviews that I recorded. It's going to be the first that you hear on the show. And I think it is perfectly appropriate that it be Ira, not just because he's such a smart guy who's thought so much about his work or because he's such a great teacher, but because he is himself a brilliant interviewer and a guy who is always looking for a magic moment.
I really am thinking about, like, what's interesting to me? Like, we you know, as a staff, like, we talk about that. Like, what's the interesting part of this thing? What do we really want to know from this person? Like, what is this story? Like, what's exciting? What's the exciting part? Like, a lot of interviews or a lot of story pitches, they have a kind of like, yeah, that's a story. It goes from here to here to here. But what's the fun part? Like, what's the part that makes you feel like, oh my God, yeah. Like without that, like, what's the point of being alive?
Ira really, really cares about the people that he's talking to. That is not, it's not a trick. It's real.
If it's going well, like going really well, and the person is really talking from the heart about a thing that means something to them, and I'm talking back to them, and we're understanding each other, and like I start to feel really close to them. I start to really like. I mean, I know that as like a professional journalist, it's not like the right thing to say this, but I start to really love them.
All right, I'm not going to keep you from this conversation anymore. One of the all-time greats. I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for him. My conversation with Ira Glass. Ira Glass, welcome to The Turnaround. Thank you for doing this.
Glad to do it.
Thank you for bringing clips, by the way. This is very exciting for me. You're like a... what's the word for this? Professional radio journalist.
I've been practicing for sure. Yeah, I've been working on my radio skills for sure.
I appreciate it. I think one of the things that people who don't know much about you don't know about you is that before you started This American Life, you were a regular public radio guy for a full 20 years or so, a reporter and a producer, starting when you had an internship as a teenager.
Yes. Yeah.
Did being a reporter fit you naturally? Like, was it an ambition for you?
No, just the opposite, in fact. Like I didn't have any special talent for being on the air. In fact, kind of the opposite. I wasn't very good on the air. And so when I started, I was basically like a tape cutter. I was a production assistant and a tape cutter and a behind-the-scenes person. And got better and better at that part of it, and then was a kind of producer who you would call in to kind of fix problem situations or to do ambitious stories. And so that was what I did. I worked for All Things Considered in Morning Edition and was just like a favorite producer of the people who managed the place. And got sent on a lot of great assignments and worked. And basically, I produced other people. I produced Robert Siegel and Renee Montaigne and Scott Simon and various reporters on various kinds of very ambitious projects and trips. And then when I was almost 30, I decided that I wanted to try to be a reporter myself, and I was not good at it. Like, it would take me like a month to do a story that would take a normal reporter like 3 days. And I didn't, I was a terrible performer on the air, and I was not good at interviewing people in a way that you could broadcast. Like their quotes were good, but I sounded terrible in the tape. And I just had to learn every single part of it.
Did you feel comfortable with the part of reporting that is just going and bothering people?
Yes. And I also felt comfortable since I was such an experienced tape cutter that I knew the tape I needed and I knew when I had the tape, which I didn't even understand was a separate skill until now that we have people who are inexperienced who come and work on our show. Or, you know, not as experienced as I was when I started to become a reporter. Honestly, one of the things that I learned we have to teach people is to decide what tape they need before they go out to get the tape and then to know when they've got it. And I didn't even understand that I had that as a skill.
I can't do that.
Come on.
No, for real, dude. I forget immediately whatever has just happened already. And I cannot recognize. I don't have developed the third eye capability. I can't talk to someone and then recognize when they said a thing that I'll use later for a thing.
What?
Yeah. I've never been a reporter or a producer or anything. I've never had a job in
radio. So you're not cutting the tape in your head? I'm cutting the tape in my head. I'm cutting the tape of this interview in my head as we're conducting it.
No, this interview will not be cut. All this garbage is staying in.
Well, so far, everything we've hit every point cleanly, so that wouldn't be a problem so far.
What kind of tape are you, when you say that you are listening for something, that you know ahead of time what you need, what does that mean?
It means that I need this person to explain this story or to explain. I mean, it depends on the kind of story. Like some stories I'm going out and I really don't know what I'm going to find, right? But more typical is I'm going out and I have a basic sense of what the person can tell me. And again, there's a range. So for example, on last week's radio show, we had a woman come in who's named Esther Perel, and she's a therapist and she has a podcast. And basically, I was walking her through a series of clips of tape from her own podcast where we hear her administer therapy to a married couple. And so I knew I was going to need her to narrate from point A to point B a couple of times and to react to things they said. And I go in with a very coherent plan for that. And then there are a couple of kind of big ideas, things I wanted to ask her about her technique and what she's doing in the sessions and about this couple. And so I have a plot that I want to get, which is going from, the story of the interview that we're telling. And then I have a couple of ideas that I know I want to drive to at different points. And so there's a real typed out, thought through plan but that's a very specialized kind of interview where I kind of have a picture of the piece beginning to end before the piece has ever been made. Miki Meek, one of our producers, and I are doing some reporting in a small town in Alabama. And this is a story that's kind of a political fable about this town, which in Alabama is the town where there have been more immigrants than any other town, and is the town that Jeff Sessions and others have pointed to as being exemplary of the problem that immigrants bring to America. And basically, we're going in and saying, is Jeff Sessions right? Has a flood of mostly Mexican immigrants to this town made the town worse, driven native-born Americans out of jobs, brought up the crime rate, driven down wages? Is that true? Let's just go in and just, is it factually true? And it turns out some of those things are true and some of them aren't. And some of them are sort of complicated in a really wonderful way, an interesting way. So this is one of those projects which is it takes us months to do, and there's so much reporting, and we're getting so much more tape that will end up on the air. And with those interviews, we go into the interview talking to people who are in the city council when the city council tried to take action about these immigrants. And we just know a bunch of moments in the history of the town that we're trying to get them to explain, what happened? Tell me the story of this. What did you think? What were the politics of it? And there it's a much more free-ranging kind of interview. But even there, there, I'm going in with a plan of like, there's a bunch of stories I want to get you to tell me. I have no idea what the answer to these questions are, like what happened in this particular council meeting on this day. But I want you to narrate through the whole thing as a narrative. Like you know, when the meeting starts, like, what is everybody's position, you know, and what happens over the course of the meeting? What did people say? What do you remember? And then, and you know, where did you come on the out on the other side of it? So even in that case, when I'm doing an interview, I'm looking for narrative. Like, what I'm making is narrative, and then I'm looking for narrative from the interviewees. And then there are certain places that I need people to jump out and give me the big picture idea of the story, which in this case is Jeff Sessions right about this town? You know what I mean? Like, is that story correct? And if he's not right, what is he not getting exactly right? And there's a bunch of like big idea questions too. And so in this model of doing an interview, since I'm making narrative, I'm looking for narrative. And I've said this many times in many places, but the structure of stories on our show in this kind of narrative journalism is there's plot and then there are ideas. And those are the two elements that you're constantly monitoring to know whether or not you've got them. And plot, I feel like when people hear that, they don't even know exactly what is meant by that. All plot is a series of actions where one thing leads to the next. Sort of like this thing led to this next thing, led to this next thing, led to this next thing, led to this next thing. And then some of the things in the list can be, and then he said this to me, and as a result, I said this back to him, and then he said this back to me, and then I got angry and I stormed out and I wrote a bill saying, you know, just like, but what you want is like one thing leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. And the reason why we do that is because once you have any sequence of actions in an order of like this happened and then this happened and this happened, that creates narrative suspense because you wonder what happened next. And once you have narrative suspense, it just makes the entire project of getting somebody to listen to a story or listen to anything you're saying so much easier because they just want to find out what's going to happen. And then you can just take them on a journey and walk them through all kinds of feelings and ideas, even on subjects that they don't think they want to hear about. You know, because they just get caught up in like, wait, like what happened next? And so it's just an enormously powerful tool for journalism, and even journalism that's like just very personal journalism about documenting somebody's personal life. You know, you just want the forward motion of events. And then the ideas that you're driving at don't have to be like the smartest ideas in the world. They just have to be kind of interesting. It just has to be like, no, that leads me to this thought. That's just kind of interesting to think about. It just, you know, it just like it doesn't have to be like brilliant. It just has to be interesting. And when I'm saying like, I know when I have the tape, like I know when I have the tape. So in these interviews that we're doing in this little town in Georgia, we're asking, we know we're sitting with somebody for like 2 hours and most of it is not going to be on the air. Most of it, we are not getting the tape. But when somebody says the thing that is the tape, then we know it. Like I'm editing in my head. And also not only am I editing in my head, but once they start, like I'm hearing it edited in my head and I'm egging them on to say more to so I can land it as a thing that'll be on the radio. And then when we walk out of those interviews, right then, Miki and I talk about what were the moments that worked best. And we'll just jot down like the 4 or 5 things that were the best things.
Do you ask people the same question over again when
oh my God, yes, over and over and over and over again. Yes, it's completely key because often they don't hear it exactly the way you mean it, and I will ask a person the same question 4 or 5 times normally before they give me an answer that's the actual answer to the question. And yeah.
You mean like when you say normally, you mean like that's your standard practice. Your expectation is that you're going to have to ask your questions 4 or 5 times.
Not every question, but certain big questions. Yeah. You have to ask over and over before the person actually is with you on the question and gives you an answer. And then often what we'll do is we'll just take the first time I ask it the first way and we'll just go to the one where they answer it. You know, though sometimes the chase is kind of interesting and we'll keep some of the ones in between. But usually like it's just a waste of time and then you just cut to the one that they answered it finally.
I feel like part of the trick of that is I've only done it a little bit when I've done interviews for a segment on Bullseye called The Song That Changed My Life, and I have to ask musicians how a song changed their life or like how they felt when they first heard it. If they don't give a good answer, then I just ask them again, or how it changed them, and I just ask them again. What I feel like is one of the things about that is you have to pull this trick, which is convincing somebody that you're asking them a different question when you're actually asking them the same question. Because if you're asking them the same question, they're just like, ugh, I just answered that.
I know that trick very well. But then the other trick to doing it is that sometimes you have to theorize what their answer might be. Like I find myself in a lot of interviews saying, well, is it more like this or is it like this? I can imagine it would be this way or this way. What is it? And then they're forced to like kind of go somewhere to bat away one of your theories and to run at one of the others.
That's something I was talking with Marc Maron about for this show, which was Maron always, I mean, just because of the way Mark's brain works, he always has an ideation about what someone's deal is and why they do the things they do. You know, sometimes a paranoid ideation. And like he will constantly in interviews just be like, huh, I bet you were like this. And that assertion might be completely true. It might be more about Mark than the person, but either way, that guest has to grapple with that in a way that is interesting. And it's something Howard Stern does that all the time, too.
Oh, my God, I know.
They just make an assertion.
A master.
Just make an assertion that they have to parry.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think about that less often. The version of that we have on our show is that anything shitty we're going to say about somebody, we say it to their face.
Is that like written on a whiteboard?
It should be. It's one of the laws of journalism. Like basically, when you think about it, like all you kind of need to know as a journalist really is you're going to be fair to everybody equally in the story, and you're going to make sure that everything is true. And if you have something bad to say about somebody, you say it to their face, so they get to give their side of it. And so partly it's just basic like journalism 101. You need to get their side of it, you know, if like and let them say you're wrong, whatever. But often that'll be like your very best tape is somebody batting that away. And also like anything that's my theory of the story. Like my theory of here's what I think their story is. I mean, I guess this is exactly like the Marc Maron or Howard Stern thing. Whatever my theory of the story is, like if I think here's what I think your story means, I say it to their face. Like we all do. We say it to their face because if we're right, we need to know that. And if we're wrong, we really need to know that. And often that's the most amazing tape is where I say, like, I think what's going on is like you have these feelings about your dad and then you just act it out. And they say, you don't understand this at all. No, here's what's really. And then they tell you the real story in exactly the way that you're saying. And yeah, yeah.
Are there situations in which you are uncomfortable asking people about things personally?
You mean in interviews?
Yeah. Not just in your like, day-to-day life. I mean, obviously you'd be uncomfortable asking certain things of like the grocery checker.
Yeah. I think there are many interviews I go into nervous. For sure, because I don't exactly know where the person's coming from and I'm nervous for how they're going to react to the questions. And I hear often on the tape that the interview is kind of stiff until I relax, which is really like an important thing to know.
So are you saying that you're nervous in part because you're not sure you have the story right?
No, I'm nervous because I'm nervous I'm going to get the story. I'm nervous about how they're going to react to some of the questions. Like, I'm nervous about the content we're going to be going through. I'm nervous about whether they're going to be frank with me. And some people just make me nervous. Like, I'm nervous around famous people. I'm nervous around, you know, I'm just nervous around people who I think will judge me.
Ira, you know you're a famous person, right?
No one is famous to themselves, I think. Or maybe they are. I don't know. Like, I don't know. My attitude. Do you know what I mean? Like, when interviewing, like, you know, I interviewed a Pat Buchanan a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, Pat Buchanan is like one of the iconic political figures of the Nixon era, you know, and forward. And you know, his famous speech at the Republican convention, you know, which said that you know, there's a culture war in this country. Like, he's just this iconic figure who I've been reading about since I was a kid. And, you know, and like, and he's a totally friendly to journalist guy. He's not like a combative Republican who doesn't want to talk to journalists. He likes talking to journalists. He was a journalist. Like, he's kind of a sweetheart in person, actually. Like, he's lovely. He's really like a lovely, decent person to deal with, and happy to like bat around ideas and talk about anything you want. But I was nervous. I was nervous at the things we were going to be asking him about. And I was nervous because he's this iconic figure.
Were you nervous in part because he is unlike most people who are on your show and most people that you probably talk to in the course of your work, a professional talker, that he is a guy who knows how
that's
to
a really good
wants
question.
To control
that's a
his
really,
own
really
stuff.
Good question. Yeah, like that was part of it, that he was going to be kind of packaged, which he wasn't, actually, which was really lovely. But often that's a huge problem, you know, when you have somebody who's a professional talker. Sometimes, for example, we'll have somebody who's like a totally wonderful comedian, and they'll have a bit that they do on stage, and we know that bit would make a great interview, and we think it'll be a better interview than just running their bit from on stage. And we think it'll be a better interview because we can get into the real emotion of it, and they wouldn't have to be like selling every punchline. And I've had the experience many, many times with people who like I adore on stage and off, where they just can't tell the story in a conversation. You know, they can't meet up with you because they just told the thing too many times on stage, and they just can't go back to what it really was. And so that's a problem. Like, yeah, professional talkers are a problem.
I interviewed John Waters the other day, who is obviously one of the most delightful human beings of all time.
I love him.
And he was kind of sick. And, you know, I mean, he's just in general, he's older than he used to be. And I had a little chat with him before we went in the studio, and he was just feeling a little beat up, you know, tired from travel and having a cold and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, ugh. And I went into the studio with him. It was the first time I'd interviewed him in person. He'd been on the show a few times by phone. And I couldn't get out of his shtick. And his shtick was great. And what ran on the radio was great. I mean, people were really into it. You know, I got in a little fight with him. But besides that, like, I couldn't. Like, he's so good at it. It was fine. And I realized, like, what a vast difference there is between a thing where you are trying to find some normal conversation and a thing where you, with a person who's a practiced speaker, and a thing where you are trying to find something fascinating and interesting with a person who is an unpracticed speaker.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a vast difference. And I could see how that could happen with him.
And I feel like the latter is something that you are astonishingly good at, or at the very least, you're good at you're astonishingly good at the post-production process. You're astonishingly good at finding the gems and putting them into something that reflects a bigger truth.
Well, to speak to the bigger point here, though, like, you know, I do interviews where that happens, where the same thing happens you're describing with John Waters, but we throw those out, or we just take the one moment that wasn't like that. And that's another thing about doing the kind of interview that I do for a living, is that we kill most of them.
Right.
Like more than half of all the interviews I do, we kill. When I was down in Alabama, we did 4 interviews over 2 days, and only one of them was good. And then the other 3, we got like 1 or 2 quotes out of. And that's normal. You know, like that's normal. Like you know, these kinds of interviews, you just kind of have to go in and hope for the best, and then throw out a lot.
How do you decide on somebody to talk to when you're doing a piece as broad as, you know, with as big a question as what happened in this town? Do you just do that thing where you walk into a diner and just start talking to people? I feel like that's every political reporter's main thing they do.
No. I mean, I'm not above that, but for this story, no, because we know the thing that we're looking for. And what we're looking for is we know the year that that Mexican workers showed up in this town. And so we know the narrative we're looking for. And what we're looking for is the exact participants, people who worked in those jobs in poultry plants when Mexican workers arrived, and the Mexican workers themselves who arrived, who are still around, like the exact people, like we're looking for the specific people who were there when this happened and the people who managed those plants. And we're looking for the specific politicians who fought over this as the years went on. And so what we're doing is we imagine a little map of the story and who would be interesting to hear from and where would you want to begin the story and where would you want it to end. And then you just start going out and reporting it out and calling people and knocking on doors, literally knocking on doors of the people who you want to get. And because like a lot of people, it isn't a good idea to just like be a voice on the phone from New York City calling like a small town in Alabama. Like it's better if you just show up and you're a human being standing in front of them who looks sort of normal and just, you know what I mean? Like people will treat you nicely if you're there. Whereas on the phone, you're just like, they don't know who the hell you are. And you know, so you make a map of the story in that case. And then the more common thing on the show, on the radio show, is that, you know, we're pitching each other possible stories and evaluating with each other, like whether we should do them at all, you know, and there, like, there's a lot of, we have a weekly story meeting and there's a pitch document where we pitch each other. Because it saves time from all of us sitting in a room and somebody like pitching the story in person. And then we all type in our comments about it and we resolve a lot of it in the document. And then some of it, then we, you know, if it's unresolvable, then we actually just talk about it as a group. And then there, what we're evaluating is the plot of the story interesting? Is it something we haven't heard before? Does it lead to some interesting thought? Does it tell us something? Like, what are the likelihood that this person's going to be a good talker if there hasn't been a pre-interview done? You know, and so those are the things we're looking for.
Wait, you're literally your argument about what goes on the air and what doesn't go on the air is in like a Google document?
Yeah, totally.
That's cool. Does everybody have their own color?
We should. That would make it much cooler to look at. No, we just type our initials next to our comment.
Oh yeah, okay, that's a pretty good system. That makes sense. Congratulations on that.
On using Google Documents for exactly the purpose for which it was created. Yes, we're very original in that way.
Stick around for more of my conversation with Ira Glass on The Turnaround after this.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband host, Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife host, Teresa McElroy.
And together we present Schmanners.
It's extraordinary etiquette.
For ordinary occasions.
We explain the historical significance of everyday etiquette topics, then answer your questions relating to modern life.
So join us weekly on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
No RSVP required.
Check out Schmanners.
Manners, Schmanners. Get it?
I'm Barbara Gray.
I'm Brandy Posey.
And I'm Tess Barker.
We're Lady to Lady. Do you want a sleepover in your ears?
Is that a friend in your pocket, or are you just podcast to see me?
We're a portable hangout you can bring to the gym, on the subway, or on an oil rig.
Seriously, we have listeners who do that.
Show with us while we get high with Margaret Cho.
Talk showgirls with Katya from Drag Race.
And hear Broadway star Anthony Rapp sing Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot. throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot.
That's Lady to Lady.
Can you keep a secret?
Neither can we.
Welcome back to The Turnaround. I'm talking with This American Life's creator, Ira Glass. Have you ever felt physically uncomfortable in an interview?
You mean like threatened by somebody physically?
Yeah, or just like, you know, creepy crawlies on your skin, you know, like that feeling of, ooh, I don't want to be there.
Yes, but not very often. Like, not even, I can't even remember. I've been in situations that have been pretty sketchy, actually, doing interviews. And, you know, like driving around with cops as we go, you know, as they go into like very dangerous situations. And, you know what I mean? Like, you know, just like actual, you know, like not very often, but actual danger. You know what I mean? Like, I've had that experience, but not very often. And more honestly, like the thing that happens to me is that if it's going well, like going really well, and the person is really talking from the heart about a thing that means something to them, and I'm talking back to them, and we're understanding each other, and like I start to feel really close to them. I start to really like. I mean, I know that as like a professional journalist, it's not like the right thing to say this, but I start to really love them. Like it has the intimacy of any like actual intimate conversation. With somebody who I feel super close to, and it's exciting because we're strangers, and so it's like a very first date-y kind of conversation. I know this all sounds awful the way I'm saying it, but like just to say to have somebody who you don't know, and then suddenly you're in talking in a very real way about something very big that happened to them and very emotional, and they really share their emotions, and then I react with my real feelings about what happened to them, and we're talking back and forth and back and forth, and we feel like we're understanding each other, and like we're sharing a thing that's real. And I feel like there's a point in my career, I was around 30, where I understood, oh, there's a power to hearing two people do that. Literally just like the feeling I'm getting in the conversation, you can hear it in the tape and it gives it to you over the air. And in the very best interviews, I feel like the intimacy of that actually like transmits over the air and gives the listener that feeling as if they were in the conversation, and gives the whole thing a lot of magnetism. I don't know a better way to say this. You just it gives you like the feeling that you get when you're having a great conversation with somebody. You know, and so, and in those moments, yeah, I totally like man, woman, child, any age, like any sex. It doesn't matter like who they are at all. Like I totally like a part of my heart is just like I really start to love them. It's the actual accurate word for what's happening.
That's unusual, right?
That happens?
Yeah.
No.
You don't think so?
I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but I do a lot of interviews so I can get to that. Like, right. That's the goal. The goal isn't just to give out information in a show like this that I'm doing. Like, the goal is to have a moment that's special. And it took me a long time. I was doing radio for a long time before I was even able to name to myself what I thought those special moments were and how to get to them. And it's a real trial and error process. I mean, that's why we throw so much stuff away, because I want it to be at that level. And I, you know, yeah, I get to that. I mean, I think at least once a week. But like to get the once a week, like I'm doing a lot of interviews.
I laughed, and it wasn't because I was laughing at your genuine emotion. It was because I was laughing at the idea of you making a show that is just about getting out the information, like one of those shows that tells fishermen when the tides are in and out.
Yeah. I wouldn't be good at that. I have to say, like, and sometimes like we'll bring people back. Can I give you like just last week, in last week's show, David Kestenbaum is the opening of the show, and he's telling how he became really sad when he started thinking about Fermi's paradox. And he and I did that interview for the opening of the show. And he wasn't feeling it. He just wasn't, nothing happened. Like kind of like as tape, there's just nothing in it. And we were in the studio for half an hour. He hit all of his plot points very competently, but it just was like, it was kind of the end of the afternoon. He just wasn't feeling it. He was referring to a real feeling he had had, something he had talked about in the story meeting. It came up in our story meeting that he'd been feeling sad about Fermi's paradox. And the interview was the opening of the show, but it also was the setup to this like 15-minute, 20-minute piece we had him do. But for the premise of the piece to work, you really had to feel like it really meant something to him. And so he and I did an interview, and I was like, you're hitting your plot points, but it doesn't feel like anything. And we came back the next day and did it again. And it's just like, I don't know, he just woke up on a different side of the bed or something, and he really had the feeling of it. And almost everything we use in the interview is from the second interview at the opening of last week's show.
Are there things that you do besides trial and error to generate that feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I try to think through what the other person would feel if they had the experience they were. You know, just like it's an active act of imagining and empathy, and you know, to get there, and so there's a lot of imagining, like what would it be like to go through this experience. There's a piece that we did a couple of now over a year ago, I guess, about this guy who the substance of the story was that he went into a hospital while having a nervous breakdown. Kind of a psychotic break, actually, and told the people in the hospital that he had a history of sort of like these kinds of things happening, he says. And or I think maybe it's even on his chart. It says in the story, which it is. But like, I think in any case, what happens is he's in his own hospital room and he gets shot by cops in his hospital room. Like he's sort of like acting up in a way that you do when you have a psychotic break, but not being violent, not hurting anybody. And cops come in, the security officers for the hospital, who are also off-duty cops, and they shoot him twice. They almost kill him. And so that's the substance of the narrative he's going to tell. What was interesting to me was that day he went from being a college student who was a functioning college student to being somebody with a psychotic break. And I was really curious in the interview to know, like, what was it like to have the psychotic break? And a lot of the questions I was imagining were about that. Like, we're about, like, what was it like? And then part of what's interesting in the interview is just my amazement at hearing what it was like, because it really was what was so interesting about it was, like, everything that he was going through to him was perfectly logical. But if you thought about it for a second, it was not logical at all. But in his logic, it was logical. And so there's a lot of, like, imagining what the other person's experience is, which any good interviewer does well. Like Terry Gross, I remember my very favorite Terry Gross interview question is this thing we're about to probably quote in an upcoming show that we're doing about magicians, where she asked Ricky Jay, the author and magician, she asked him, is there ever a trick where what's going on kind of behind the scenes that we don't see is actually more interesting than what we do see? And he got really excited. He's like, yeah. And she's like, can you give me an example? He's like, no, of course not. but if you think about the construction of that question, that's like putting herself inside his world and inside his head so thoroughly, you know. Or another question I remember she asked my cousin, Philip Glass, the composer, the very best question he's ever been asked in any interview. And I say that as somebody, I've had to interview him on stage. And so I've gone back through a lot of interviews of his to see like what people ask him and what works and what doesn't. And she asked him like the perfect Philip Glass question, which was, she asked him, have you ever tried to write music that doesn't sound like the music of Philip Glass? And he gets really excited. He's like, oh, yes, 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 absolutely. Every time. And then he pauses and he goes, and every time I fail.
Well, one of the things that I like about that Ricky Jay question, and I think to some extent it certainly speaks to what Terry Gross is so brilliant at, but also speaks to something that's of particular interest to you, is Terry Gross, this is something I only realized as an adult and as a professional interviewer, to some extent, a money-losing professional interviewer, is that Terry Gross always elegantly and simply asks for an example. She never misses an opportunity to ask for an example. And in your work, I think often what people will offer in response to a question is an idea or theoretical answer, sort of rhetorical answer. And your job as the guy who makes This American Life is to ask, okay, cool, that's great. What is the story of that answer? Which is a very similar thing. It's essentially asking for that example.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's give me the example is a lot of what I'm asking in every interview. You said that so well. I have nothing to add. I'm sorry. The answer is worse than the question in this case.
Well,
because you summarized in your question every possible thing I could say. I have no example to offer you, Jesse Thorne.
Well, here's the good news for you, Ira. That makes me a bad interviewer. Forgot to ask a question at the end of that.
Well, no. Actually, like sometimes you have to have a question like the one you just said, like where you're summarizing the entire passage of things that lasted for, that was like the previous like 3.5 minutes, maybe 3:45. You know, like you just you needed to like bring it to a head and say here's where we're landing and here's what's interesting, and then all the guests can say is I totally agree with that. And then that's it. You move on. Cut to banjo music. You know, like bring up some music. you know, or like I will if I were in your situation, or I would like you could force me into a situation right now to force me to come up with an example of me doing that. You know what I mean? Like because you know what I mean? Like you could totally push it one more round, but I think the one more round would simply reiterate where we already were, and so you were wise to just move on. Can I say, like, yeah, all I said is yes and when I'm the interviewer, I hate it when the interviewee does that. And there used to be like a This American Life cliche that we really don't do anymore, where like in the interviews, like at the top of the show, like I will do what you just did. I'll do the whole summary. And so I think it's this. And the person will go like, yep. And then we totally do bring up the music. And like hope nobody notices that the interview didn't really say anything. But like we just sort of got the idea out there. And that's that, you know,
well,
whatever.
I mean, that's one of the things that Terry Gross is so good at is she doesn't do that. She so consistently tricks the guest into saying the summary of what they have to say. Like, that is an astonishing skill to me. But she also hosts a very different kind of show than yours. I mean, you know, for one thing, on your show, you are much more of a character on your show than she is on hers. She is if to the extent that she's a character on her show, it's inferred, you know?
Yeah.
And you actually reveal yourself a little bit. Like you will, not that she never does this, but you know, you have thoughts and feelings about whatever's going on.
Yes. Yeah. No. And we're doing a kind of feature journalism, like more like a magazine feature than like a newspaper story. Where in our style, it's not just the story is about the interviewees, but it's clearly seen through the lens of me and the other reporters, and so we don't hold back on our feelings about what we think is really happening, all within a kind of mainstream media context where we don't take a side in a political fight, But yeah, we make clear how we feel about the people because I think it just gives the whole thing way more feeling.
You do that much more than would be done in a news context on NPR. I mean, you act frankly, you guys have changed NPR to some extent, but you still do it much more than NPR would do.
I think there are very few examples of things on our show that I did not do when I was a reporter and producer at NPR. The range of things that we do is still within the range of things that I used to get onto a morning edition and All Things Considered. And occasionally there'll be a move that goes further, you know, occasionally. But I have to say most weeks there's nothing in our show that I couldn't have gotten onto morning edition and All Things Considered when I was
right.
a producer there.
Well, Ira, it's not about what you could have gotten on there. Of course you could have gotten it on there. You knew exactly where the weak points and the defenses were. And you were really good. I'm sure you were the outlier. Like when I talked to Audie Cornish, who's, you know, as brilliant as it gets, I thought I was going to ask her about, you know, don't you ever have feelings about things and then it's weird not to say them? Because I feel like that all the time. And she very emphatically and very sincerely said, oh, absolutely not. It's not about me. And very clearly and passionately made that point. Like, yeah, not about me. Never about me. It's about whatever's going on. I'm not
See,
part
but
of
I
that.
Feel like it, but I feel the same way. I feel like it's not about me. It's about whatever's going on. But through me, you see that because I understand what radio is. I don't know. And I say with respect to Audie, who I think is wonderful. And can I also say, like I think at NPR, within the NPR news shows, where, you know, I started working at NPR in the 1970s, just like 5 or 6 years after the network began. And I worked there until 1995 when I started This American Life. And there was there were always people who, who showed less of themselves, and there were always people who showed more. And I feel like there are just a bunch of different ways to be on the air, always at NPR on the news shows, and that seems fine. Do you know what I mean? Like, Audie doesn't have to. That's not her thing. She's great. It's, you know, she's about something else. She's great at something else. And but there were, you know, others of us who were doing a different thing in the same space, and both were permitted. And I think both are permitted now.
Are you as, you know, I've talked to you a number of times on a few times on my show and a few times in real life in like social or semi-professional contexts. And you never fail to bring your enormous empathy muscle to bear upon me. You never fail to like ask me about almost immediately about something important and how I feel about it in my life. Do you feel as comfortable being the subject of that or opening your own feelings and emotions up as you do opening up the can of other people's emotions?
You mean in my personal life or you mean on the radio?
Either or both.
I mean, over the last few years, at the urging of my spouse, I've become much more articulate in personal situations about talking about my feelings, and in fact, even knowing what my feelings are. Like, I've talked about this on stage, how like there have been many situations where I have been asked, you know, like, so how do you feel about that? And I'll sort of like survey my own feelings, and just nothing comes up. Like I look on the radar screen, and there's no planes coming in at all, you know. And I've consciously trained myself to understand better what I'm feeling in all kinds of personal situations that I think I was just sort of like shutting down. Now, that's maybe a more personal answer than you're asking for, but it's a truthful answer. And on the radio, I've always felt like it's better for me to be more personal, for me to in any situation where it seems like that's the appropriate place for the conversation to go, I go there. And it was interesting to me on our 500th show, we did a kind of a look back at different things. And Sarah Koenig, she was like, that was something she had always noticed about my interviews. It's like, if there's a chance for me to say something personal, or if there's not a chance, but if there's an appropriate turn to deepen the conversation to say something personal, I'll say it. And honestly, like a lot of times I say it, then we cut it out of the interview. And because it just like ends up not fitting into the pacing of the story and not being relevant enough to go there. But over time, I've gotten much more comfortable. And in fact, like just a couple months ago, I feel like I really took a turn in this and that I wrote more personally about a thing than I ever have on the air ever. And that is like within a few weeks time, my wife and I decided that we were going to split up. And the person who I talk to every day, a friend of mine from the neighborhood, who's 89 years old, who I knew from the dog park, but talked to every day, and we traveled to Ireland together, and we were very close. She died, and suddenly I was in a moment in my life where the two people who were the two closest people to me were gone, and it was odd. And there was a theme that came up the week that my friend Mary died, that it was appropriate to talk about. And just like I wrote a draft of a thing and kind of read it to the staff or, you know, to some of the staff in an edit, and they didn't know that I had separated from my wife 3 years before. They didn't know that we were thinking of splitting up. Like, this was because I feel like I'm their boss, and it's just weird if your boss is telling you all kinds of personal stuff in the office. And so they didn't know any of that. They found it out in the edit, which I apologize for, knowing how completely symbolic and maybe not the best way to handle things it was, but there we were. And, you know, like I love the people I work with, and you know what I mean? Like we work together, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I could say more about that too. But anyway, so maybe it wasn't the exact best way to handle it with them, and basically read this very personal piece of writing to them. And I was like, I don't even know, does this belong on the radio? And they're like, yeah, this belongs on the radio. And so then we put that on the radio.
How is it reflected in your life that you are more willing in a non-professional context to recognize and be open about your feelings?
I mean, I think, I mean, honestly, like, I feel like I've become a better friend to my friends and a little happier. I don't know. Like, it just is, it turns out being awake to your own feelings is just like a helpful thing.
I feel bad when I talk about myself in my interviews. I mean, I think maybe partly it's because I don't have the same ability to cut things out that you do. Like, I'm cutting out so much less than you are. And I think in my head, I'm always not cutting out anything just because I did my show live for a long time. But I feel weird about it. And then people email me and complain about it if it's on the air.
They complain if you talk about yourself?
Yeah.
Because they just want to hear the guest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, John Waters is better than me. You know what I mean? I'd rather listen to John Waters than me, too. Or whoever, George Saunders, Maria Bamford, whoever it is, right? They're on the show because they're so great. So I understand.
I think it depends on what you're talking about. I think that if they're telling a story about something that's meaningful to them and you have a story about the same thing that's meaningful to you, you would be just, you're just as interesting. Like, you know what I mean? Like, or anybody. Like, I'm not saying this is like, oh, you're awesome, Jesse. Like, I'm saying this is like, I don't know. To me, that's following the conversation where it should go. And sometimes, yeah, like sometimes that stuff shouldn't be in because we should just get out of the way and I'm glad to cut that stuff. But sometimes, sometimes it's right. It's interesting. I realized like one of the things that actually got me on the path of telling personal stories is that when I was still an NPR producer, I started working with this really wonderful reporter named Margie Rocklin, who works out of LA. And Margie was sort of well known among editors and people who are just like pay attention to celebrity journalism for like she's who you would send in to talk to like Nicole Kidman. And Nicole Kidman would be like a real person with her. I mean, maybe Nicole Kidman's like, maybe she's not, I don't know what she's like as an interviewee with other people, but like, you know, somebody who's like been interviewed a million times, super famous, generally like a little bit guarded around the edges or a lot guarded around the edges. You send in Margie and they come off like a human being. And I worked with Margie on a bunch of stories and I realized, oh, the thing that Margie is doing with these super famouses is that Margie has like a personal story that just comes out of her that's in any situation. And when she's saying like, you know, she's talking about like when you're divorced, okay, I would think about this, like this thing happened in my family with my sister. And the, like, and she would just like, Margie would tell these like very real stories that were meaningful to her. And then when somebody tells you a story, it's hard if you're normal not to tell them a story back. And any interview is like a party that you are throwing as the interviewer, and anything that you do, the person naturally mimics back to you. And so if you're kind of a little bit of a stiff, then the person will be a stiff back. And if you're telling stories and you're sort of warm, and Margie's super warm, very funny, like people just want to rise to her level, and so they meet her where she is in a way that like Maron does. Like Maron is so like, he makes you meet him at like, he is so like out there with his feelings that you feel like even just to stay in the conversation, you know, you really have to meet him at that level with his feelings, where his feelings are. And I found when Maron interviewed me, I was like, this is incredibly powerful. Like the undertow of talking to this guy and it was really like, it reminded me of the lesson of how important that is to like his bareness emotionally created a context where it was really hard not to be bare emotionally. And all of which to say, if you are responding with that level of bareness to the interviewees that you want from them, like I think that your listeners, if they're complaining, they're wrong. Like I do. Like I think that it's appropriate for you to do, and that probably it actually is the most interesting thing that you could be putting on.
There's something in what Stern does in that same way. That Stern is so...
Oh, my God. Agreed.
Stern just creates a hole and someone better fill it because of social obligation, essentially.
No, he is the master. But Strand does this other thing that's like so fucking diabolical and wonderful, is that he creates a kind of peer pressure reality of consensus. It's like a whole room full of people going, oh, yeah, of course, it's normal to talk about this. And then people are just like, yeah, it is kind of normal. And then they're just like, they're just joining the party, you know. But Stern himself is so nervy and willing to say any personal thing about himself, really. And he's interesting, you know, he's a super interesting man, and he's very funny. And you just kind of like, yeah, you walk into that room, I'm sure, and you can't help it.
I have the This American Life comic book. This is this comic book that you and Jessica Abel put together 15 years ago or something.
That later she updated it into a full book that's amazing for anybody who wants to make narrative journalism, where she expanded it out and went to all these other shows, Snap Judgment and Radiolab and The Moth and there's a full book out there that only costs like $7 called Out on the Wire, and it's wonderful. She killed it.
And in the This American Life comic book, which I used to use, I had to teach the radio class at KZSE in Santa Cruz with no qualifications at all. None. I had never done journalism or radio.
Why were you teaching that class?
Because there was no radio teachers, and they had to have a class in order to get credit for things. And so
why wouldn't they just hire somebody who had done radio?
you don't understand how public universities work, Ira. There was only one employee at the whole station. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, ask your girl Julie Shapiro. She went there. Maybe she's good because they had a teacher there or something. But anyway, I used to use that This American Life comic book. I didn't know. I don't know. But it's cost $5, so I can tell people to buy it and they won't complain. And the thing that most vividly sticks out in my mind is this explication of a question that you can use in any situation. I want to say it was maybe Alex Chadwick's question or something.
Noah Adams.
There you go. Which is, well, you know what it is then. Tell me what it is.
It's been so long since I've thought about this. It's like he said that like a question that always works is, how did you think this was going to work out before it happened? And then how did it really work out? Is that it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And you then explain why it's a good question.
Which I think the thing I say in the comic book is that because you get two stories,
right?
And you get the shift between them. You get the kind of like, here's how I thought it would go, which is one story, and then they're forced to be, and then here's how the reality is different than the dream of that, and then the jump between the two is just kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it basically forces someone to generate this American Life story, which is to say, it forces them into narrative. It forces them into another narrative, and because they've given these two narratives, it forces them into reflection, right? Like, there's no choice but to compare them.
Yeah.
Are there any other things that you feel like you just gotta, are crutches that you've developed over the years? And I mean crutches in a good way.
It's funny, I never use that.
Really? I feel like I use it. I'm now showing my cards, but if people listen to Bullseye, you'll hear that in half the interviews.
Yeah, no, I never use that. Maybe unconsciously it's coming up because it's so deep in my background. But no, like the thing I'm doing in an interview, when I go in, my notes are like, what are the plot points I want to be sure to try to get for this story? And then what are the possible ideas the thing could drive to? And then that's enough. I know if I get that, then I've got it.
And then
often I have a gimmicky idea for the beginning or ending of the interview. You know, like I'll have like gimmicky thoughts about like funny ways to ask things. Like I'll have like not exactly trick questions, but just like things that I think would be funny to do.
Ira, can you give me an example of that?
Excellent interviewing, sir.
Thank you.
Let me think for a second.
That's the pull quote, by the way. Excellent interview, Ira Glass.
With Pat Buchanan, I asked this question that's kind of a gimmicky question. And I went in with it. And we actually ended up cutting it because just for pacing and all. But it was totally one of these gimmicky questions. And it was, are you to Donald Trump what Barry Goldwater was to Reagan. And for the story to work, I have to explain who Barry Goldwater is and his influence on how it basically Reagan basically repackaged Goldwater. So that would have to, you have to, the listener would have to know that information. But like, so the question was like, are you to Donald Trump what Barry Goldwater was to Reagan? Are you to Donald Trump what John the Baptist was to Jesus? Take those one at a time. That was my question. And then he laughed and he told me a story about when he worked in the Reagan White House. And it was like, it was lovely as tape, but like in the end, the pacing of the piece was like, we cut it. But that's what I'm saying. It's a gimmicky, it's a very gimmicky question.
Do you want to play a clip? Because I feel like we teased clips at the beginning. We're basically out of time.
I do want to play a clip. And, okay. And this will speak to your Audi Cornish point. And that is what happens when you have the people in the tape. And the thing I want to say is, hold on for a second, I need to push a button or two here to bring up the clip on the board.
Shout out to Ira running his own board over there.
Axan, okay. And then what I'm going to play you is, this is Alex Bloomberg, and this is the first clip of tape in this story that we did about what it's like to be on an aircraft carrier. We were on the aircraft carrier a couple months after after September 11th. It's a very old clip of tape, actually, right? So we're in like January 2002, and this is an aircraft carrier where planes are taking off to fly missions in the early stages of the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan. This is before we had Bagram Air Base or other air bases in Afghanistan. So basically, to have jets in that war, we had to fly them off aircraft carriers. And so this is the piece of tape that opens the show after a little piece of script. And basically, and what I'll have you notice is Alex Bloomberg's affect in the tape. I'm going to mix music in with this live, perhaps a little crudely. And so what this is we start the show, and what this is we start the show, and I have a piece of script where I say, like, our enemies are in hiding, some are in caves, you know, some have gone to the mountains, you know, but on an aircraft carrier, you know, an American sailor is doing her part in the war against terror.
My name is Creevon Scott. Just filling up the vending machines.
Is that your full-time job?
Yes.
It's your full-time job?
Yeah. Filling up vending machines all day for 12 hours.
What are the big sellers?
Like right now it's Snickers and Starburst. Snickers goes real fast.
What's the least favorite candy on board?
Bonkers, the fruit chews. We got boxes of those and still have them. Sometimes if we don't have anything else, we'll just put it all rolls of Bonkers and they'll still stay in here.
Some people hate Bonkers. Yeah. There's just nobody likes Bonkers.
We still got them, but we've been ordering a whole lot of new stuff, so I've been trying to keep like a whole variety of things in here. Like Crunchy Munch, we just got the Crunchy Munch, and the Cheez-Its we normally didn't have in here.
Cheez-Its?
Yeah, the Cheez-Its, the different kind of Cheez-Its.
I'm going to stop the music. So the thing I would point out is that like part of what makes the quote interesting is Alex's delight and amusement at this. He had no idea this could be a job that you could be doing as a full-time job on an aircraft carrier. But there's 5,000 people on this ship, and this is somebody's job in the war on terror. And like his pleasure in it is part of what makes it work. All of which to say, like, it's a story about Creevon, the girl, but seeing it through the lens of his pleasure makes it good. And it leads us to a bigger point, which is like most people in a war like this aren't dropping bombs. Like on the entire ship, there's, I think, I can't remember, 50, 100 people who actually fly the jets that drop the bombs. Everybody else, 4,900 other people, are basically like running the radar and, you know, loading bombs onto stuff and fixing the air conditioning and, you know, just like, and doing the vending machines, doing laundry, you know, like, and like,
my
and
dad
this
was
is a story
on a carrier, he was a projectionist.
He was a projectionist?
Yeah.
You mean just like slides and stuff?
No, movies. He's seen the movie A Thousand Clowns. Have you ever seen that movie? It's a great, wonderful movie. But he's seen it like 500 times.
Is A Thousand Clowns the one where they invented the montage of people falling in love?
Yes.
Yeah. Ralph Rosenblum writes about that in his book, When the Shooting Stops, the Cutting Begins. Yes. It's crazy that didn't exist, a montage of people falling in love over music. And then it's there with Jason Robards playing the banjo and singing, right?
Yeah, yes, sir. That's my baby. It's amazing, wonderful movie. One of my all-time favorites. But anyway, he's seen it 1,000 times because he was a projectionist on an aircraft carrier.
So that's what I'm saying. So we're doing a piece of journalism. We're documenting this part of the world, but it's Alex's pleasure. And when I'm talking to young journalists about like what do they need to do as journalists, I feel like one of the things that gets left out is to just be aware of your own amusement. Like the more you're in touch with what gives you pleasure, kind of like the better the thing will be. And that's what's going to make it good. Just understanding your pleasure. And making it clear to the listener that's a lot of what makes something good, and your curiosity too, like all of those things.
Like there's a feeling that I feel like people that for me is hard to remember, but I try to remind myself of, which is a basic kind of what do I wonder about this? Like if there weren't rules, there wasn't mm-hmm. propriety, there wasn't if it was just my job to wonder about things, which. Spoiler alert, is my job, mm-hmm. then what do I wonder about? Like, do I wonder, whether Terry Crews really loves yogurt? Like, his character on Brooklyn Nine-Nine is really into yogurt. Hmm. Yeah, turns out Terry Crews genuinely loves yogurt. I kind of wondered, I kind of wanted to know. And it seems like the good moments come out of that kind of sincere... I mean, that was a thing in watching Larry King that I was like, oh, that's all he does. I mean, he obviously doesn't prepare. He basically he's just very open about what he wonders about.
Huh.
But it's a that's hard thing to do because you always feel like you're, I don't know. I always feel like I'm edging into impropriety whenever I ask someone about something like that, or like I should be asking them something important or something.
That's so interesting. Like that you worry that you're edging into impropriety. Like I never think that.
Well, that's obvious,
it doesn't
bud.
Even occur to me. Like no, I feel like God, you were badly raised. Like who hit you as a kid, Jesse Thorne? that you feel like something bad is going to happen if you ask somebody about whether or not they like yogurt. Like that's crazy.
Can we just talk about that? People's boundaries.
What?
I just respect people's boundaries. It's a weird thing to ask.
But I'm saying the only reason why you're respecting people's boundaries is because obviously you feel like you want that respected in you. You don't want anybody, edging in on your boundaries.
Yeah, like, I think. Didn't we just talk about that like 20 minutes ago?
No, I'm saying like you gotta let go of that. I don't think that's a useful feeling to have. I rarely worry about that. Like when I'm trying to think about what's interesting to me, I really am thinking about like, well, what's interesting to me? And like we as a staff, like we talk about that. Like what's the interesting part of this thing? What do we really want to know from this person? Like what is the story? Like what's exciting? What's the exciting part? Like a lot of interviews or a lot of story pitches. They have a kind of like, yeah, that's a story. It goes from here to here to here. But what's the fun part? Like, what's the part that makes you feel like, oh my God, yeah. Like without that, like, what's the point of being alive? What's the point of making radio? Like, if you're not going to have that in every story, like, what's the point of doing journalism? Like, it's not that interesting. I mean, actually, that's not true. It's super interesting. It's like an amazing job. But like, just like it can be so much more interesting if you do this.
Well, Ira, I think that seems like a good note to end on. That was mad inspirational.
Okay. All right. Well, eager to serve as always. It's interesting that it's a parallel to the thing of me being more in touch with my feelings in my private life. Because I feel like I'm so in touch with them in my professional life, like so deeply in touch with them that I feel like in a way it slowed down my development in my private life. I became so sensitive to my feelings in a workplace setting.
You also work compulsively. I mean, as far as I can tell, I feel like you work 77,000 hours a day.
That makes it sound like it's a problem, though, when you say it that way. Like when people call it work, like he's a workaholic, that makes it sound like it's a disease instead of a choice.
I mean, to be fair, you don't have children and your life is your own. And I bet you enjoy your work. I hope you enjoy your work.
I do enjoy the work. Yeah. I'm very lucky to have a job I can stand.
Fair enough. I mean, go to town. That's my position on it.
All right.
Ira, thank you so much for making accommodations to take time out of your crazy busy schedule. It's always great to get to talk to you. I mean that for real.
Yeah, no, I enjoy it too. It's super fun talking to you.
And Ira, I think you know this. I may even have said this to you, but I'm very grateful for I'm very grateful for you and your work. I don't think I would probably be doing this job, as different as my job is from yours. I don't think I ever would have thought that there was there would be room for me in public radio if it weren't for your work. So,
wow,
it means
that's
a lot
super
to
nice
me.
Of you
so
to
thank
say.
Thank you very much.
All right. I'm glad it worked out.
Okay, bud. Well, we'll talk to you soon again, I hope.
Okay. I hope so, too.
Okay. Bye.
Okay.
That was Ira Glass. He created and hosts This American Life, which you can get on your local public radio station or via podcast. They also created as a team the Smash Hit Podcasts, Serial and S-Town. That's the turnaround. Hey, if you liked this week's program, please tell somebody about it. That's our marketing budget, people. You can find it on MaximumFun.org, on YouTube, wherever you find podcasts. However is easiest to refer it to someone, please do that. If you're listening to the show for the first time, subscribe. All our music given to us by Mobius Van Chalkstraw. You can check his stuff out at chopsmusic.com. The Turnaround, a production of MaximumFun.org, presented in partnership with the Columbia Journalism Review. Their mission, to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. Learn more at cjr.org, where you can find edited transcripts of all of our interviews. They also have a great podcast that you should check out called The Kicker. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse. It's produced by Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost. We'll catch you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.